Good morning, Sandra. What a real treat to see you.
Well, nice to be here. Thank you.
We were so sad that you were not able to come last March, but you know, the whole world kind of blew up on us. And that was for the publication of your most recent book, Westering Women. So since we didn't get to talk about it, maybe you could give us a few highlights of the book.
The story is about a group of women who go west ostensibly to get married. Two ministers put together the idea and recruit the women in Chicago in about 1852. And it's a story of women's strengths. The men, for various reasons, kind of drop out along the way, the Teamsters and so on. And the women are left with running this wagon train by themselves. And they develop a lot of skills they didn't know they had, and they understood the importance of working together as a kind of sisterhood. Each woman has a different story, and there's, you know, a variety of women. One is a prostitute who wants to change her life. The protagonist is a woman who is running from an abusive husband, and she feels that if he can't find her, he'll kill her and their daughter. And then there, you know, several others who have reasons for wanting to leave.
So it's a story of endurance and survival and community and cooperation, all those things that are very prevalent in our today era, although you've put it back a century or more.
I think that's true. It's a sense of the importance of working together, of recognizing each other's strengths, of recognizing your own strength.
So is the trail, I mean, is this an Oregon Trail story, essentially?
Not Oregon Trail, California Trail. But it's an Overland Trail story. And there are the usual things in it, dysentery, Indian attacks, but other things, lack of food, the horrible problems of getting through the Sierras in the winter when the storms come. It's a long trip, it's a 6-month trip.
It's a terrible trip, and the reason I ask is that we did an event with Douglas Preston for Old Bones, which revolves around the Donner Pass Party, and learned from that that the trail had a fork or a potential shortcut, which turned out to be a disaster for the Donner Party, to go through the Sierras in the winter. So I've kind of paid attention to it. And traveling in Colorado, you can go across parts of the trails, but I can't remember if they're mostly the Oregon Trail or if they're mostly the California trails.
The trails split off in Wyoming or Utah. One of the problems was nobody knew where they were going. There were a lot of booklets. It was pretty easy to get to Salt Lake. Everybody knew how, or to get the cutoff just before Salt Lake if you were going on the Oregon Trail. It was, from then on, there were cutoffs that were dangerous. Some were actually promoted by people who had trading posts and they wanted the pioneers to go and buy supplies from them. So they encouraged them on some of these bad bypasses. But beyond that, they simply didn't know. They had an idea of what the trail was, but they didn't always know what it was. So there was a lot of backing up and moving forward and finding another way. And then once they got to the California desert, they pretty much knew where they were going. But again, it was so difficult. The deaths on the Overland Trail, I don't remember the figure, but it seems to me like 10% of the people who went west died. And of course the women walked pregnant or else they were nursing children. Enormous number of women, something like 1 in 4 was pregnant during that trip.
Yes, I know that no medical care, whatever, will be so hard. I was an undergraduate at Stanford, and of course, the university really celebrated Leland Stanford and, you know, the completion of the Transcontinental Railroad with the famous Golden Spike thing. But, you know, I don't think we recognize what an amazing achievement that was when otherwise you had to cross the continent on some combination of foot, horseback, ox cart, whatever it might be. And then the railroad came along and, you know, simplified a lot of it, partly because, as you say, the tracks, at least everybody knew where they were going.
Yes, railroads were a huge benefit, but they didn't come until later, what, 1870s maybe?
Yeah, at least. It was somewhere in the, I think, mid-1870s, 1876 or something like that. So no, you're writing before that. I just meant that it didn't seem when I was a young undergraduate like that big a deal, you know, because we were used to railroads. And it's only later reading books like yours that you recognize what a transformative thing a transcontinental railroad was.
It was an awful event. It took months and months and months. You might go 10 miles a day and you walked most of that. Riding in a wagon was so uncomfortable and so boring that you tended to walk.
How true. So you've always been really interested in the West, Sandra. I remember the Persian Pickle Factory was the first book of yours I read. Was it your first book?
It was my second book.
Second book. And I just loved it. I thought that, again, you had women and a sense of community, but then we discovered that the sense of community wasn't exactly what we thought. And then you've written books set in, like, you know, a working girl's house in, where was it, New Mexico somewhere? I mean, you know, why are you so fascinated with setting novels in the West?
Because I'm Western. I was born in Virginia, but I moved to Denver when I was six. I tried to write a book, New Mercies, set in Natchez. I did write the book. I tried to write it from a Southern viewpoint. And I realized that I'm not Southern, that you can learn about a lot of things. You know, there's that old saw that you write about what you know about. Well, you can learn about a lot, but you can't always learn the mindset. And I realized when I tried to write that book, I didn't have a Southern mindset. I didn't have that kind of graciousness. I thought the North won the Civil War, and that's not always the foregone conclusion in the South. And I, so I had to write from the standpoint of a Colorado woman who went to Natchez and saw the what was going on there through her eyes. And I love Western history. Before I ever got into fiction, I wrote about 10 books on the West.
So what drew you into writing fiction?
A couple of friends and I decided we were going to write a bodice buster. And we, one was a work for People magazine, and another was a ski writer, and I worked for Business Week magazine. And so we outlined this book and we assigned characters. I remember we had a French count and countess because we figured we could go to Paris and do research. And we wrote some of it, but our styles didn't mesh. My stuff sounded like an annual report, and the ski writer stuff was like a travelogue, and the People magazine lady had all of these one word sentences like, wow. So we realized pretty early on that this wasn't going to work. But I realized then how much I liked writing fiction. And I had never really written it before. I had a book out of that I'd written after college that I knew was so bad that I'd never even reread it. And I pulled it out and I rewrote it and I sent it off to my agent. And she said it wasn't publishable at that time. And I kept rewriting it. It was eventually published as a book called The Chili Queen. And then I wrote a woman's Western and she said, there is no such thing. But now, of course, we have an enormous number of women writing about this. And then I wrote a book called The Buster Midnight's Cafe. And that was my first published novel.
So did you have an agent in your career as a magazine writer? Because it's, you know, not everybody has an agent before they ever begin writing a novel.
No, I worked on staff for Business Week. I didn't freelance for it. A fellow who was on the staff had just written a book called On a Third Day You Could See General Motors, which was one of the first business books. And he said, if you ever need an agent, I've got a great one. And so I wrote her and proposed some nonfiction books, none of which she liked. And then I tried fiction and she kept turning it down. But I was so lucky to have an agent. I had no idea at the time how difficult it was to get an agent. And I've been with the same agency the whole time.
It is extremely difficult. It's a question that is often asked at writing workshops about, you know, how do I get an agent? Sometimes getting an agent is harder than actually finding a publisher. Although today they it's a two-step deal. Most publishers require an agent, so that's your first step. But I do find oftentimes when I talk to authors, Sandra, they got an agent through another, you know, an acquaintance, a business associate, an author that was published like their work and referred it to their agent. You know, there's Sometimes it seems like lucky breaks have as much to do with it as any sort of scientific approach.
Yes, if this fellow, we were in a meeting, a McGraw-Hill conference, and it was, we were both really bored, and he said, let's get out of here, I'll tell you about my book. If I hadn't sat next to him, I wouldn't have that agent. So I was really lucky. And not all agents are good, too. I was very fortunate to get a good one.
Wow, that is a wonderful story. So, Ryan, we had a discussion last night with a new author and his really legendary editor, Jason Kaufman at Doubleday. And one of the things we talked about was the advance of narrative nonfiction, in other words, writing, you know, with the force of storytelling, but nonetheless, everything is fact-based. And then writing fiction, but researching it so that much of what's in the fiction is true, whether real characters or actual events. And I find it interesting that there's this kind of increasing convergence where the key is a narrative drive, and what it is you're writing about seems somewhat secondary. Have you found that to be true?
There's a lot of narrative fiction. There's a, what's that hybrid called? It's fictionalized nonfiction kind of stuff that historical fiction or fiction based on historical or real characters, I think, is legitimate. Some of it I don't like because they take too much liberty with the facts. I think if you are writing about something that actually happened, if you're writing about an event that happened, you have to stay loyal to those facts. And there are a lot of writers who will change them. I remember reading a book saying this labor strife actually took place in 1907 instead of 1905, but I changed it because it works better with my book. I don't think that's legitimate. I think it's okay to make up dialogue as long as it's appropriate dialogue. Today we have so many books set in historical time periods that use a variety of obscenities that really weren't used back then. And the dialogue is so inaccurate because of some of the words used or some of the attitudes. I mean, we know that women were not considered equals 150 years ago. But we have so many books now with men considering women equal. It's just not very accurate. And it makes for good fiction, maybe. I don't care for it.
Well, it's true. I'm a big fan of the Regency. I guess I was branded with Jane Austen, but even more important, Georgia Hare when I was young. And yet I read an increasing amount of whether romance or whatever it is, set in the Regency with women who were rebellious, you know, in order to be interesting as fictional characters, but really would not have survived in society. Or they sometimes, if they're real bodice rippers, they're far more sexually, they flaunt it more than they ever would have been able to do without losing their reputation. And so I do find that it's become kind of a modern hybrid in many cases. I've gone off reading a lot of it.
It's what I call the Dr. Quinn medicine woman syndrome. It's and you see a lot of this with books about women in the West. They love Indians. They stand up to men. They're newspaper editors, lawyers, and they're great characters, but they're not very accurate.
So when you write, you try to write women as they would have been, as you feel that they would have been, but then what do you give them as roles they can play that actually propel a story?
I think I'm guilty of a tiny bit of what I'm complaining about. My women are always a little stronger than they probably would have been back then. Because if you write about them as they actually were, they're kind of boring characters, you're right. But I try to portray them against a background that the reader will see as lack of opportunities. The kind of conflicts that the women themselves may not recognize, but the reader does. Lack of job opportunities, inability to vote, all the kinds of prejudices that existed about women back in those times.
Plus, just being pregnant without medical care was a constant risk, you know. I mean, even today, we lose babies and lose mothers, but the mortality rate was so much higher that I often wonder if women who were constantly pregnant weren't also rather constantly afraid, but maybe not.
Oh, that's true. And when you read some journals, I mean, most journals don't get into sex, but you read occasionally about the fear women have of getting pregnant. I remember reading an article once, some letters or something, a woman who locked her bedroom door, and her husband would pound on the door, but she was so frightened of pregnancy that she wouldn't let him in. The problem was not so much that they feared pregnancy and they feared dying, because a lot of them were religious. They feared leaving their children behind. The husband wouldn't be able to raise them, so the children would either be parceled out to relatives or friends or anybody, or else the husband would go into town and find another wife and she'd be cruel to the children. And that was the biggest fear that women had.
Yes, and there's certainly, I'm thinking back to, is it Benjamin Harrison that had like 14 or 15 children, and then his wife wore out and died, and then he married some other woman and had another 14 or 15 children? Or if you look at Bach, who had, I can't even remember how many children, you know, sometimes it was George III, you know, the extraordinary number of children, and oftentimes many of them died, so you couldn't necessarily guarantee that if you had 12 pregnancies, you know, you might only raise five or six of the children.
Pregnancy really controlled women's lives. And there were women, when you read feminist history, there were women who wouldn't marry just because they didn't want to be called a woman.
Exactly. Spinster was not necessarily a the problem was economic to a great degree, and even and social, you know, that an unmarried woman occupied a rather often a difficult place because it was hard to have a job opportunity, as you've already mentioned. It was really difficult to make a living. So you think about somebody like Louisa May Alcott, you know, who, I mean, we think of Little Women, but she wrote all kinds of stuff which were called then penny dreadfuls, and we would call them pulp fiction. Because, you know, writing was a way that a woman could support herself, at least in the 19th century.
And so many women had no skills, and they were shunted from relative to relative. You know, there was always the maiden aunt. Even when I was growing up, I had friends who had maiden aunts living with them, and my friends used to have to share a bedroom with them. And it was a really sad thing. But there were no job opportunities. You could be a teacher if you were educated, but so many women weren't. And so you read about the drudgery that women faced. There's a book, Emily, the Diary of a Hard Worked Woman, that in which she tells about cleaning and maybe getting a quarter or some old clothes, and just she I think she probably worked herself to death. It was so difficult.
Well, they could, but on the other hand, you know, oftentimes maiden aunts and spinsters lived to a much older age than married women because they weren't constantly pregnant,
Yes.
and therefore they could go through a couple of generations of children. I think Austen writes very well about the plight of single women, you know, which carries over to the West. And I remember once asking Elizabeth Peters, because I love her Amelia Peabody mysteries, you know, where women would like go up the Nile or explore darkest Africa. And I said to her, so what did women do who had husbands or lovers and they were going to be, you know, traveling in these? And what did they do about sex? And she said, really, abstinence was the only surefire birth control. You know, everything else could fail. So it's probably part of, you know, women were assigned roles in nunneries and so forth. Unmarried women or unwanted daughters or surplus daughters. But on the other hand, they got to live together and thrive without going through the childbearing cycle. So, you know, I think it was more of a choice than sometimes we think, that maybe women just didn't want to go through all that. But I think in regard to westering women, that had to be a real consideration. If you were going to start off on the California Oregon Trail, should you know, take pregnancy into account?
And these women didn't all want to get married in my book. They wanted to go west for a variety of reasons. And ostensibly, they went west to find husbands. But they had other reasons for wanting to go, for getting away from abusive situations, or in one case, finding a brother who had gone west and lost contact with the brother. And so while most of them did marry, not all of them did.
Mm-hmm. Good to keep in mind. So the Persian Pickle Factory, let me come back to that. What a great idea for a novel. What, I don't want to give away why I think it's so great, but where did the inspiration for it come from?
My parents were married in 1933, and they both lost their jobs, and they moved to my grandparents' farm in Kansas. And that summer, a neighbor offered my dad a day's work in the field, said he'd pay a dollar, and Daddy worked so hard that he finished by noon and made just 50 cents. And that was always a story that we were brought up with. And I liked that. And Mother always told about when they finally met. Well, Mother said, my mother worked harder than anybody I ever knew, but farming was not her food. And she said that she was going to go into Topeka and she was going to talk herself into a job and she wasn't coming back until she did. And so she did exactly that. So I had those things, and I was, it was before quilting really took off. I knew there were quilters out there. I didn't know that there were something like, I don't know how many millions of them, and they spend several billion dollars a year on books and supplies. And I liked the idea of just putting all that together. I don't know where the idea for the plot came from. It just occurred to me. I was in the mountains sitting in a hammock and my husband was doing all this work. And I thought, I have to come up with a plot to justify not doing anything. So I came up with the plot, and the first draft of the book was not very good. It was just one of the characters saying, let me show you my quilts. And my agent turned it down. And then I was talking to her later and said, I don't know what to write. And she said, why don't you pull out that quilt book and see if you can do anything with it? And so I read it and rewrote it. And the original ending was really vague. The final ending was just somewhat vague.
I love the way it ends up. In fact, I love the fact that the story you think you're reading is not necessarily the real story. I thought of you because on one trip driving around outside Durango, Colorado is in fact a quilting co-op or something, if you want to call it that, where it's a store that sells supplies and everything, but they also do classes. And they had some gorgeous quilts that were for sale. I fell in love with one, which is really too small for the king size bed, but I loved it so that I bought it to use it more like a throw or something. You know, you wouldn't sleep under it because it wasn't really big enough, but it could be decorative. And I had a terrible time talking the woman who'd made it into selling it to me because she liked using it for demonstration for her classes. But you know, there is a, what do I want to call it? Hobby seems a little too soft a word, but there are whole circuits of people with special interests everywhere you turn. I mean, there are dog shows, or, you know, and cat lovers, and there are quilters, and there are gardeners, and there are, you know, you just name it.
Writing mysteries about every one of them.
Well, yeah, what they really are just little communities, you know, of people who form. And while there are many things about the internet that I don't think have been good for society, I do think that the way that it can connect people with similar interests, you know, on a wider scale than if they all live in some town, is fascinating. And yes, mystery, lots of mysteries have picked up on these communities, you know, women who bake, or, you know, sort of like the Great British Baking Show. I watched it accidentally once and I thought, well, the people were so weird that I didn't really want to spend time with them. But nonetheless, the length that these people go to like decorate a cake is so extraordinary. I mean, it's like Rodin at work, or you think of Michelangelo on his back or something, you know, painting the Sistine Chapel. I don't mean it rises to those heights, but the inspiration and the dedication that goes into making these things absolute works of art, it's just, I could hardly believe it.
That's true with quilting now. Traditionally, quilting was just a way of making bed covers that were pretty, putting artistry into it, because women traditionally were not encouraged to be artists. And quilting was also a social activity for women. Women couldn't just get together and talk. They had to be doing something of value. And so they get together and quilt. And there was a kind of sisterhood that formed around quilting circle. And women would, one of the things that I did with the Persian Pickle Club, I don't know how to turn that off.
Don't worry.
Was that the, it was during the Depression, and women had a really rough time. They had to make everything work at home. Their husbands didn't have jobs, but they were the ones who kept the families going, who found money for food, and they understood each other. They didn't get a lot of credit for this, but the women understood each other. And over a quilting frame, they could talk about this. They could share their concerns and the things that that bothered them, and give each other support.
We have in our dining room an 18th century quilt that is truly remarkable. I didn't think about taking a photo of it, but I'll send you one. And it's, in some ways, it reminds me of a giant sampler, you know, because that was another art form that women would do. But it is three-dimensional in that it has some patterns in it that are more dimensional than, you know, it isn't a flat quilt. Colors are extraordinary. And it was handed down in my husband's family. So the Antiques Roadshow came to either Tucson or Phoenix, I can't remember which. And we had been looking at the quilt because we'd finally bought a house where we had a wall big enough to have it framed and hung on the wall. I mean, it takes a big wall to do that with a quilt. So my husband took the quilt with him to get it appraised. And we were actually delighted to discover that someone had done some repair work to it, which had then made it not a genuine antique. I think it might have had some machine stitching or some other sort of stitching. So we were elated because now it wasn't worth, you know, six figures. It was worth somewhere in the low fives or something. So we took it to the Phoenix Art Museum, where they have a conservator, a fabric conservator, and she conserved it and mounted it on a board, and we had it framed. It weighs a ton. But it always excites comment, and it's the big thing you see when you walk into our house. So I do think of quilts as art forms, but I also recognize that it was a way to use up scraps and, you know, worn out materials, sort of like rag rugs is the same principle, isn't it?
Oh, I think probably so. I don't think rag rugs were as attractive, and people didn't save them. Quilts were practical, and now we see them. The designs and the graphics in quilts are beautiful. Some of the old ones, and I have one that's a flag quilt that was made out of from a pattern that was in Godey's Lady's Book in 1861. There's one in the Metropolitan Museum, I think, made from that same pattern. And they're wonderful. They're statements. There was one pattern called Drunkard's Path. And a lot of them are involved in, a lot of them represent interests that women had, you know, the Women's Christian Temperance Union, which was very much a woman's organization. I mean, we kind of smirk at it now, the idea of all these women going around trying to close saloons. But drunkenness was a real problem for women in the 19th century because they were dependent on their husbands. And so they formed these. But quilt patterns represent a lot of social issues over the years.
Yes, they do. Earlene Fowler wrote a wonderful mystery series in which all of the titles were quilt patterns, recognize the drunkard's path and so forth. I was sad when she stopped writing them, but I think, you know, a very long running series at some point, either the characters are exhausted or the author is exhausted or however it works. But I own them all. And I often think about what the names of the quilts represented at the time they were done. Today, so many patterns are machine generated. that, in fact, I think the one that I bought in Durango was a complicated pattern that may well have been computer generated.
And a lot of are quilted on machines that are programmed. I mean, these huge long arm machines that can do everything. I prefer the old quilts because they have little errors in them that make them very human. I have a child's quilt that's done in cheddar yellow and double pink and brown. And right in the bottom corner is a little piece of blue. And you know that the quilter ran out of fabric and she either didn't have the money to go to the store or the fabric wasn't available, for whatever reason, she used this little piece of blue in it. And you'd never do that today, but they did things like that back then.
No, you wouldn't do it with a quilt, but you know, that unfortunately happens. Happens with makeup. You find like a lipstick color you love, and then, you know, the manufacturer changes everything up and you can't get it anymore. It's true with flooring, for example. We did some remodeling and was really annoyed to discover that the wood floor that we had in one room, that we couldn't get the wood anymore. So, you know, there is today it's a planned obsolescence rather than an accidental or, you know, we just ran out of it sort of obsolescence. It actually, I think, is a marketing contrivance, certainly in the cosmetic industry. And perhaps in the home decor industry as well, which is frustrating. So what are you thinking of working on, Sandra? I'm of the theory that very few writers stop writing, you know, that storytelling is kind of a compulsion. So even if you slow down, you're probably still thinking about what next.
My agent has a book, which she's presented actually a couple of books to St. Martin's, and I haven't heard anything about that, so I don't know what's happening there. Plotting is really hard for me, and I'm having trouble coming up with a plot. And I have to do it myself. Readers suggest plots a lot, but I've never picked up on one that anybody suggested, and I can't figure out what to write now. I was thinking for a while about doing something about the orphan train, but so much has been done about that I just don't want to get into that. And I just don't know what to write about. So I'll get an idea and start on it. But right now, and it's a great time to write because we're all quarantined from coronavirus. So we can't go out and do anything. But I just can't figure out what I want to do next.
Well, I think if you try to force it, it won't work. It will just have to come to you. And you're right. In one sense, everybody has more leisure time. But we found talking to so many writers that some just find this so unsettling they can't focus on work, and others are in the bunker mentality, you know, they're home and so they're doing extra work. I think we all react differently to the situation that we're in.
It is. Although I think I write better in difficult times because it's a way of taking myself out of it. Well, my husband was so ill this year. I wrote a whole lot. I wrote every day. I spent all day at the hospital with him. But before I went, at like 7 a.m, I would write. And that was a very productive time. So I wish I could figure out what I'm going to do next, but I just don't know.
Well, I'm sure you'll see your way forward. I'm so fond of your work. I'm always excited to see another novel by you. So I will hope that something seizes you. And I hope you'll be able to, you know, to visit us in the future. I know that looking after your husband and the pandemic have coincided so that it's difficult for you to think about getting away, but who knows where we're going.
Well, I'd love to be there.
Great. Well, thank you for taking time to talk to me today. I really appreciate it and wish you well. Let me know if inspiration strikes so I can at least be heartened by the thought of Sandra at work.
I will, thank you.
You're welcome. Bye.
Bye.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.